7.
You go first, Adam said. Ask me anything. That's the only fair trade.
They were sitting in a booth in an old-style diner named Caesar's, where Auster had suggested they meet. The place wasn't busy, and the adjacent booths were empty, so there was no need to censor themselves or talk in code. Auster gestured at the generous serving of chocolate cream pie that Adam had begun demolishing.
Can you really taste that? Absolutely.
And it's the same as before?
Adam wasn't going to start hedging his answers with quibbles about the ultimate incomparability of qualia and memories.
Exactly the same.
He pointed a thumb toward the diner's three booths behind him.
I can tell you without peeking that someone's eating bacon. And I think it's apparent that there's nothing wrong with my hearing or vision, even if my memory for faces isn't so good.
Which leaves?
Every hair on the bearskin rug,
Adam assured him. Auster hesitated. Adam said,
There's no three-question limit. We can keep going all day if you want to.
Do you have much to do with the others?
Auster asked.
The other side loads? No. I never knew any of them before, so there's no reason for them to be in touch with me now.
Auster was surprised.
I'd have thought you'd all be making common cause, trying to improve the legal situation.
We probably should. But if there's some secret cabal of immortals trying to get re-enfranchised, they haven't invited me into their inner circle yet.
Adam waited as Auster stirred his coffee meditatively.
That's it, he decided.
Okay. You know, I'm sorry if I was brusque at the funeral,
Adam said.
I was trying to keep a low profile. I was worried about how people would react.
Forget it.
So, you knew me in New York?
Adam wasn't going to use the third person. It would make the conversation far too awkward. Besides, if he'd come here to claim the missing memories as his own, the last thing he wanted to do was distance himself from them.
Yes.
Was it business, or were we friends?
All he'd been able to find out online was that Auster had written a couple of independent movies. There was no record of the two of them ever working on the same project. Their official bacon number was 3, which put Adam no closer to Auster than he was to Angelina Jolie.
Both, I hope,
Auster hesitated, then angrily recanted the last part.
No, we were friends. Sorry, it's hard not to resent being blanked, even if it's not deliberate.
Adam tried to judge just how deeply the insult had cut him.
Were we lovers?
Auster almost choked on his coffee.
God, no! I've always been straight, and you were already with Carlos when I met you.
He frowned suddenly.
You didn't cheat on him, did you?
He sounded more incredulous than reproving.
Not as far as I know.
During the drive down to Gardenia, Adam had wondered if the old man might have been trying to airbrush out his infidelities. That would have been a bizarre form of vanity or hypocrisy or some other sin the world didn't have a name for yet, but it would still have been easier to forgive than a deliberate attempt to sabotage his successor.
We met around 2010,
Auster continued.
When I first approached you about adapting Sadlands.
Okay.
You do remember Sadlands, don't you?
My second novel,
Adam replied. For a moment, nothing more came to him. Then he said,
There's an epidemic of suicide spreading across the country, apparently at random, affecting people equally regardless of demographics.
That sounds like the version a reviewer would write.
Auster teased him.
I spent 6 years, on and off, trying to make it happen.
Adam dredged his mind for any trace of these events that might have merely been submerged for lack of currency, but he found nothing.
So should I be thanking you or apologizing? Did I give you a hard time about the script?
Not at all. I showed you drafts now and then, and if you had a strong opinion, you let me know, but you didn't cross any lines.
The book itself didn't do that well, Adam recalled. Auster didn't argue.
Even the publishers stopped using the phrase slow-burning cult hit, though I'm sure the studio would have put that in the press release, if it had ever gone ahead.
Adam hesitated. So, what else was going on?
The old man hadn't published much in that decade, just a few pieces in magazines. His book sales had dried up, and he'd been working odd jobs to make ends meet. But at least back then, there'd still been golden opportunities like valet parking.
Did we socialize much? Did I talk about things?
Auster scrutinized him.
This isn't just smoothing over the business at the funeral, is it? You've lost something that you think might be important, and now you're going all Dashiell Hammett on yourself.
Yes, Adam admitted.
Auster shrugged.
Okay, why not? That worked out so well in Angel Heart.
He thought for a while.
When we weren't discussing Sadlands, you talked about your money problems, and you talked about Carlos.
What about Carlos?
His money problems.
Adam laughed.
Sorry. I must have been fucking awful company.
Auster said,
I think Carlos was working 3 or 4 jobs, all for minimum wage, and you were working 2, with a few hours a week set aside for writing. I remember you sold a story to the New Yorker, but the celebration was pretty muted, because the whole fee was gone instantly to pay off debts.
Debts?
Adam had no memory of it ever being that bad.
Did I try to borrow money from you?
You wouldn't have been so stupid. You knew I was almost as skint. Just before we gave up, I got 20 grand in development money to spend a year trying to whip Sadlands into something that Sundance or AMC might buy. And believe me, it all went on rent and food.
So what did I get out of that?
Adam asked, mock jealously.
2 grand for the option. If it had gone to a pilot, I think you would have gotten 20, and double that if the series was picked up.
Auster smiled.
That must sound like small change to you now, but at the time it would have been the difference between night and day, especially for Carlos's sister.
Yeah, she could be a real hard ass.
Adam sighed. Auster's face drained, as if Adam had just maligned a woman that everyone else had judged worthy of beatification.
What'd I say?
You don't even remember that?
Remember what?
She was dying of cancer. Where did you think the money was going? You and Carlos weren't living in the Ritz or shooting it up.
Okay.
Adam recalled none of this. He'd known that Adelina had died long before Carlos, but he'd never even tried to summon up the details.
So Carlos and I were working 80-hour weeks to pay her medical bills, and I was bitching and moaning to you about it, as if that might make the magic Hollywood money fall into my lap a little faster?
That's putting it harshly, Auster replied. You needed someone to vent to, and I had enough distance from it that it didn't weigh me down. I could commiserate and walk away.
Adam thought for a while.
Do you know if I ever took it out on Carlos?
Not that you told me. Would you have stayed together if you had?
I don't know,
Adam said numbly.
Could this be the whole point of the occlusions? When their relationship was tested, the old man had buckled, and he was so ashamed of himself that he tried to erase every trace of the event. Whatever he'd done, Carlos must have forgiven him in the end. But maybe that just made his own weakness more painful to contemplate.
So I never pulled the pin?
He asked.
I didn't wash my hands of Adelina and tell Carlos to fuck off and pay for it all himself. Auster said, not unless you were lying to me to save face. The version I heard was that every spare dollar you had was going to her up until the day she died. Which is where 40 grand might have made all the difference, bought her more time, or even a cure. I never got the medical logistic details, but both of you took it hard when the Coleman thing happened. Adam moved his half-empty plate aside and asked wearily, so what was the Coleman thing? Auster nodded apologetically. I was getting to that. Sundance had shown a lot of interest in Sadlands. But then they heard that some Brit called Nathan Coleman had sold a story to Netflix about, well, an epidemic of suicide spreading across the country, apparently at random, affecting people equally regardless of demographics. And we didn't sue the brazen fuck into penury? Auster snorted. Who's this we with money for lawyers? The production company that held the option did a cost-benefit analysis and decided to cut their losses. 22 grand down the toilet, but it wasn't as if they'd been cheated out of the next Game of Thrones. All you and I could do was suck it up and take a few moments of solace whenever a Sadlands fan posted an acerbic comment in some obscure chat room. Adam's visceral sense of outrage was undiminished, but on any sober assessment, this outcome was pretty much what he would have expected. Of course, my faith in karma was restored, eventually, Auster added enigmatically. You've lost me again. The old man's success, once he cut out all the middlemen and plagiarists, must have been balm to his wounds, but Auster's online footprint suggested that his own third act had been less lucrative. Before they'd finished shooting the second season, a burglar broke into Coleman's house and cracked open his skull with a statuette. An Emmy? No. Just a BAFTA. Adam tried hard not to smile. And once Sadlands fell through, did we stay in touch? Not really, Auster replied. I moved here a long time after you did. I wasted 5 years trying to get something up on Broadway before I swallowed my pride and settled for playing script doctor. And by then you'd done so well that I was embarrassed to turn up asking you for work. Adam was genuinely ashamed now. You should have. I owed it to you. Auster shook his head. I wasn't living on the streets. I've done all right here. I can't afford what you've got, he gestured at Adam's imperishable chassis. But then, I'm not sure I could handle the lacunae. Adam called for a car. Auster insisted on splitting the bill. The service cart rattled over and began clearing the table. Auster said, I'm glad I could help you fill in the blanks, but maybe those answers should have come with a warning. Now a warning? The Coleman thing. Don't let it get to you. Adam was baffled. Why would I? I'm not going to sue his family for whatever pittance is still trickling down to them. In fact, he couldn't sue anyone for anything, but it was the thought that counted. Okay. Auster was ready to drop it, but now Adam needed to be clear. How badly did I take it the first time? Auster gestured with one finger, drilling into his temple. Like a fucking parasitic worm in your brain. He'd stolen your precious novel and murdered your lover's sister. He'd kicked you to the ground when you had nothing and taken your only hope away. Adam could understand now why they hadn't stayed in touch. Solidarity in hard times was one thing, but an obsessive grievance like that would soon get old. Auster had taken his own kicks and decided to move on. That was more than 30 years ago, Adam replied. I'm a different person now. Aren't we all?
Auster's ride came first. Adam stood outside the diner and watched him depart, sitting confidently behind the wheel, even if he didn't need to lay a finger on it. 8. Adam changed his car's destination to downtown Gardenia. He disembarked beside a row of fast food outlets and went looking for a public web kiosk. He'd been fretting about the best way of paying without leaving too obvious a trail, but then he discovered that in this municipality, the things were as free as public water fountains. There was no speck of entertainment industry trivia that the net had failed to immortalize. Coleman had moved from London to Los Angeles to shoot the series, and he'd been living just a few miles south of Adam's current home when the break-in happened. But the old man had still been in New York at the time. He hadn't even set foot in California until the following year, as far as Adam recalled. The laptop that he'd started excavating had files on it dating back to the 90s, but they would have been copied from machine to machine. There was no chance that the computer itself was old enough to be carrying deleted emails for flights booked 3 decades ago, even if the old man had been foolish enough to make his journey so easy to trace. Adam turned away from the kiosk's chipped projection screen, wondering if any passers-by had been staring over his shoulder. He was losing his grip on reality. The occlusions might easily have been targeted at nothing more than the old man's lingering resentment. If he couldn't let go of what had happened, even after Coleman's death, even after his own career had blossomed, he might have wished to spare Adam all that pointless, fermented rage. That was the simplest explanation. Unless Auster had been holding back, the thought of the old man murdering Coleman didn't seem to have crossed his mind, and if the police had come knocking, he would surely have mentioned that. If nobody else thought the old man was guilty, who was Adam to start accusing him, on the basis of nothing but the shape and location of one dark pit of missing memories among the 30% of everything that he didn't recall? He turned to the screen again, trying to think of a more discriminating test of his hypothesis. Though the flow into the side load itself would have been protected by a massive firewall of privacy laws, Adam doubted that any instructions to the technicians at Lodestone were subject to privilege. Which meant that, even if he found them on the laptop, they were unlikely to be incriminatory. The only way the old man could have phrased a request to forget that he'd bashed Coleman's brains out would have been to excise all of the more innocent events that were connected to it in any way, like a cancer surgeon choosing the widest possible sacrificial margin. But he might also have issued the same instructions merely in order to forget as much as possible of that whole bleak decade, when Hollywood had fucked him over, Carlos had been grieving for the woman who raised him, and he'd somehow, just barely, kept it together, long enough to make a new start in the 20s. Adam logged off the kiosk. Auster had warned him not to become obsessed, and the man was the closest thing to a friend that he had right now. If everyone in the industry really staved in the skulls of everyone who'd crossed them, there'd be no one left to run the place. He called a car and headed home. 9. Under protest, at Adam's request, Sandra spread the 3 sturdy boxes out on the floor and opened them up to reveal the foam, straps, and recesses within. They reminded Adam of the utility trunks that the old man's crews had used for stowing their gear.
"Don't freak out on me," she pleaded.
"I won't," Adam promised. "I just want a clear picture in my mind of what's about to happen."
"Really? I don't even let my dentist show me his planning videos."
"I trust you to do a better job than any dentist."
"You're too kind."
She gestured at the trunks like a proud magician, bowing her head for applause.
Adam said, "Now you have no choice, El Dissecto. You've got to take a picture for me once it's done."
I hope your Spanish is better than you're making it sound.
I was aiming for vaudevillian, not voseo.
Adam had some memories of the old man being prepared for surgery, but he wasn't sure that it was possible to rid them of survivor's hindsight and understand exactly how afraid he'd been that he might never wake up. Sandra glanced at her watch.
No more clowning around. You need to undress and lie down on the bed, then repeat the code phrase aloud 4 times. I'll wait outside.
Adam didn't care if she saw him naked while he was still conscious, but it might have made her uncomfortable.
Okay.
Once she left, he stopped stalling. He removed his clothes quickly and began the chant.
Red lentils, yellow lentils, red lentils, yellow lentils, red lentils, yellow lentils.
He glanced past the row of cases to Sandra's toolbox. He'd seen inside it before, and there were no cleavers, machetes, or chainsaws. Just magnetic screwdrivers that could loosen bolts within him without even penetrating his skin. He lay back and stared at the ceiling.
Red lentils. Yellow lentils.
The ceiling stayed white, but sprouted new shadows, a ventilation grill, and a light fitting, while the texture of the bedspread beneath his skin went from silken to beaded. Adam turned his head. The same clothes he'd removed were folded neatly beside him. He dressed quickly, walked over to the connecting door between the suites, and knocked. Sandra opened the door. She'd changed her clothes since he'd last seen her, and she looked exhausted. His watch showed 11:20 p.m. local time, 9:20 back home.
I just wanted to let you know that I'm still in here, he said, pointing to his skull.
She smiled.
Okay, Adam.
Thank you for doing this, he added.
Are you kidding? They're paying me all kinds of allowances and overtime, and it's not even that long a flight. Feel free to come back here as often as you like.
He hesitated.
You didn't take the photo, did you?
Sandra was unapologetic.
No. It could have gotten me sacked, and not all of the company's rules are stupid.
Okay. I'll let you sleep. See you in the morning.
Yeah.
Adam lay awake for an hour before he could bring himself to mutter his code word for the milder form of sleep. If he'd wished, Lodestone could have given him a passable simulation of the whole journey, albeit with a lot of cheating to mask the time it took to shuffle him back and forth between their servers and his body. But the airlines didn't recognize any kind of safe flight mode for his kind of machine, even when he was in pieces and locked inside 3 separate boxes. The way he'd experienced it was the most honest choice. A jump cut, and 13 hours lost to the gaps. In the morning, Sandra had arranged to join an organized tour of the sites of San Salvador. Her employer's insurance company was more concerned about her safety than Adam's, and in any case, it would have been awkward for both of them to have her following him around with her toolbox.
Just keep the license on you,
she warned him before she left.
I had to fill out more forms to get it in than I would to clear a drone's flight path 2x around the world, so if you lose it, I'm not coming to rescue you from the scrapyard.
Who's going to put me there?
Adam spread his arms and stared down at his body.
Are you calling me a Ken doll?
He raised one forearm to his face and examined it critically, but the skin around his elbow wrinkled with perfect verisimilitude.
No, but you talk like a foreigner, and you don't have a passport. So just stay out of trouble.
Yes, ma'am.
The old man had only visited the city once, and with Carlos leading him from night spot to childhood haunt to some cousin's apartment like a ricocheting bullet, he'd made no attempt to navigate for himself. But Adam had been disappointed when he'd learned that Beatriz was now living in an entirely different part of town. There'd been no cues along the way, no hooks to bring back other memories of the time. Colonia Laico was 30 minutes drive from the hotel. There were more autonomous cars on the street than Adam remembered, but enough electric scooters interspersed among them to keep the traffic from mimicking LA's spookily synchronized throbbing. The car dropped him off outside a newish apartment block. Adam entered the antechamber in the lobby and found the intercom.
Beatriz, this is Adam.
Welcome. Come on up.
He pushed through the swing doors and took the stairs, ascending 4 flights. It wouldn't make him any fitter, but old habits died hard. When Beatriz opened the door of her apartment, he was prepared for her to flinch, but she just stepped out and embraced him. Maybe the sight of wealthy Californians looking younger than their age had lost its power to shock anyone before she'd even been born. She ushered him in, tongue-tied for a moment, perhaps from the need to suppress an urge to ask about his flight or inquire about his health. She settled, finally, on,
"How have things been?"
Her English was infinitely better than his Spanish, so Adam didn't even try.
"Good," he replied. "I've been taking a break from work, so I thought I owed you a visit."
The last time they'd met had been at Carlos's funeral. She led him into the living room and gestured toward a chair, then fetched a tray of pastries and a pot of coffee. Carlos had never found the courage to come out to Adelina, but Beatriz had known his secret long before her mother died. Adam had no idea what details of the old man's life Carlos might have confided in her, but he'd exhausted all the willing informants who'd known the old man firsthand, and she'd responded so warmly to his emails that he'd had no qualms about attempting to revive their relationship for its own sake.
"How are the kids?" he asked.
Beatriz turned and gestured proudly toward a row of photographs on a bookcase behind her.
"That's Pilar at her graduation last year. She started at the hospital 6 months ago. Rodrigo's in his final year of engineering."
Adam smiled.
"Carlos would have been over the moon."
"Of course,"
Beatriz agreed.
"We teased him a lot once he started with the acting, but his heart was always with us. With you, and with us."
Adam scanned the photographs and spotted a 30-something Carlos in a suit, beside a much younger woman in a wedding dress.
"That's you, isn't it?"
He pointed at the picture.
"Yes."
"I'm sorry I didn't make it."
He had no memory of Carlos leaving for the wedding, but it must have taken place a year or two before they'd moved to L.A. Beatriz tutted.
"You would have been welcome, Adam. But I knew how tight things were for you back then. We all knew what you'd done for my mother."
"Not enough to keep her alive," Adam thought.
But that would be a cruel and pointless thing to say. And he hoped that Carlos had spared his sister's children any of the old man's poisonous talk of the windfall they'd missed out on. Beatriz had her own idea of the wrongs that needed putting right.
"Of course, she didn't know herself. She knew he had a friend who helped him out, but Carlos had to make it sound like you were rich, that you were loaning him the money, and it was nothing to you. He should have told her the truth. If she'd thought of you as family, she wouldn't have refused your help."
Adam nodded uncomfortably, unsure just how graciously or otherwise the old man had handed over paycheck after paycheck for a woman who had no idea who he was.
"That was a long time ago. I just want to meet your children and hear all your news."
"Ah,"
Beatriz grimaced apologetically.
"I should warn you that Rodrigo's bringing his boyfriend to lunch."
"That's no problem at all."
What 20-year-old engineer wouldn't want to show off the animatronic version of great uncle movie star's lover to as many people as possible? When Adam got back to the hotel, it was late in the afternoon. He messaged Sandra, who replied that she was in a bar downtown having a great time and he was welcome to join her. Adam declined and lay down on the bed. The meal he'd just shared had been the most normal thing he'd experienced since his embodiment. He'd come within a hair's breadth of convincing himself that there was a place for him here, that he could somehow insert himself into this family and survive on their affection alone, as if this one day's hospitality and good-natured curiosity could be milked forever. As the glow of borrowed domesticity faded, the tug of the past reasserted itself. He had to keep trying to assemble the pieces, as and when he found them. He took out his laptop and searched through archived social media posts, seeing if he could date Beatriz's wedding. Pictures had a way of getting wildly mislabeled, or grabbed by bots and repurposed at random, so even when he had what looked like independent confirmation from four different guests, he didn't quite trust the result, and he paid a small fee for access to the Salvadorian government's records. Beatriz had been married on March 4th, 2018. Adam didn't need to open the spreadsheet he was using to assemble his timeline for the gaps to know that the surrounding period would be sparsely annotated, save for one entry. Nathan Coleman had been bludgeoned to death by an intruder on March 10th of the same year. Carlos would hardly have flown in for the wedding and left the next day. The family would have expected him to stay for at least a couple of weeks. The old man would have been alone in New York, with no one to observe his comings and goings. He might even have had time to cross the country and return by bus, paying with cash, breaking the trip down into small stages, hitchhiking here and there, obfuscating the bigger picture as much as possible. The dates proved nothing, of course. If Adam had been a juror in a trial with a case this flimsy, he would have laughed the prosecution out of court. He owed the old man the same standard of evidence. Then again, in a trial, the old man could have stood in the witness box and explained exactly what it was that he'd gone to so much trouble to hide. The flight to L.A. wasn't until 6 in the evening, but Sandra was too hungover to leave the hotel, and Adam had made no plans. So they sat in his room watching movies and ordering snacks from the kitchen while Adam worked up the courage to ask her the question that had kept him awake all night.
Is there any way you could get me the specifications for my targeted occlusions?
Adam waited for her response before daring to raise the possibility of payment. If the request was insulting in itself, offering a bribe would only compound the offense.
No,
she replied, as unfazed as if he'd wondered aloud whether room service might stretch to shiatsu.
That sheet is locked down tight. After last night, it would take me all day to explain homomorphic encryption to you, so you'll just have to take my word for it. Nobody alive can answer that, even if they wanted to.
But I've recovered bills from his laptop that mention it, Adam protested. So much for Fort fucking Knox.
Sandra shook her head.
That means that he was careless, and I should probably get someone in account generation to rethink their line items. But Lodestone would have held his hand very, very tightly when it came to spelling out the details. Unless he wrote it down in his personal diary, the information doesn't exist anymore.
Adam didn't think that she was lying to him.
There are things I need to know, he said simply. He must have honestly believed that I'd be better off without them. But if he'd lived long enough for me to ask him face to face, I know I could have changed his mind.
Sandra paused the movie.
Very little software is perfect, least of all when it's for something as complex as this. If we fail to collect everything we aim to collect...
Then you also fail to block everything you aim to block, Adam concluded. Which was probably somewhere in the fine print of his contract. But I've been racking my brain for months without finding a single stone that punched a hole in the sieve.
What if the stones only got through in fragments, but they can still be put together?
Adam struggled to interpret this.
Are you telling me to take up repressed memory therapy?
No. But I could get you a beta copy of Stitcher on the quiet.
Stitcher?
It's a new layer they'll eventually be offering to every client,
Sandra explained.
It's in the nature of things. With the current methods, that the sideload will end up with a certain amount of implicit information that's not in an easily accessible form. Thousands of tiny glimpses of memories that were never brought across whole, but which could still be described in detail if you pieced together every partial sighting.
So this software could reassemble the shredded page of a notebook that still holds an impression of what was written on the missing page above?
Sandra said.
For someone with a digital brain, you're about as last century as they come.
Adam gave up trying to harmonize their metaphors.
Will it tell me what I want to know?
I have no idea,
Sandra said bluntly.
Among the fragments bearing implicit information, and there will certainly be thousands of them, it will recognize some unpredictable fraction of their associations and let you follow the new threads that arise. But I don't know if that will be enough to tell you anything more than the color of your sweater your mother was wearing on your first day of school.
Okay.
Sandra started the movie again.
You really should have joined me in the bar last night,
she said.
I told them I had a friend who could drink any Salvadorian under the table, and they were begging for a chance to bet against you.
You're a sick woman, Adam chided her. Maybe next time.
10. Reassembled back in California, Adam took his time deciding whether to make one last algorithmic attempt to push through the veil. If the truth was that the old man had been a murderer, what good would come of knowing it? Adam had no intention of confessing the crime to the authorities and taking his chances with whatever legal outcome the courts might eventually disgorge. He was not a person. He could not be prosecuted or sued, but Lodestone could be ordered to erase every copy of his software, and municipal authorities instructed to place his body in a hydraulic compactor beside unroadworthy cars and unskyworthy drones. But even if he faced no risk of punishment, he doubted that Coleman's relatives would be better off knowing that what they'd always imagined was a burglary gone wrong had actually been a premeditated ambush. It should not be for him to judge their best interests, of course, but the fact remained that he'd be the one making the decision, and for all the horror he felt about the act itself and the harm that had been done, his empathy for the survivors pushed him entirely in the direction of silence. So if he did this, it would be for his benefit alone. For the relief of knowing that the old man had simply been a vain, neurotic self-mythologizer who tried to leave behind the director's cut of his life, or for the impetus to disown him completely, to torch his legacy in every way he could, and set out on a life of his own. Adam asked Sandra to meet him at Caesar's Diner. He slid a small parcel of cash onto her seat, and she slipped a memory stick into his hand.
What do I do with this? He asked.
Just because you can't see all your ports in the bathroom mirror doesn't mean they're not there.
She wrote a sequence of words on a napkin and passed it to Adam. It read like Jabberwocky, mistranscribed by someone on very bad drugs.
4 times, and that will take the side of your neck off without putting you to sleep.
Why is that even possible?
You have no idea how many Easter eggs you're carrying.
And then what?
Plug it in, and it will do the rest. You won't be paralyzed. You won't lose your consciousness. But it will work best if you lie down in the dark and close your eyes. When you're done, just pull it out. Working the skin panel back into place might take a minute or two, but once it clicks, it will be a waterproof seal again.
She hesitated.
If you can't get it to click, try wiping the edges of both the panel and the aperture with a clean chamois. Please don't put machine oil on anything. It won't help.
I'll bear that in mind.
Adam stood in the bathroom and recited the incantation from the napkin, half expecting to see some leering apparition take his place in the mirror as the last syllable escaped his lips. but there was just a gentle pop as the panel on his neck flexed and came loose. He caught it before it fell to the floor and placed it on a clean square of paper towel. It was hard to see inside the opening he'd made, and he wasn't sure he wanted to, but he found the port easily by touch alone. He walked into the bathroom, took the memory stick from the side table, then lay down and dimmed the lights. A part of him felt like an ungrateful son, trespassing on the old man's privacy, but if he'd wanted to take his secrets to the grave, then he should have taken all of his other shit with them. Adam pushed the memory stick into place. Nothing seemed to happen, but when he closed his eyes, he saw himself kneeling at the edge of the bed in the room down the hall, weeping inconsolably, holding the bedspread to his face. Adam shuddered. It was like being back in the servers, back in the interminable side-loading dream. He followed the thread out into the darkness, for a long time finding nothing but grief. But then he turned and stumbled upon Carlos's funeral, riotous in its celebration, packed with gray-haired friends from New York and a dozen of Carlos's relatives, raucously drowning out the studio executives and sink-flashing the paparazzi. Adam walked over to the casket and found himself standing beside a hospital bed, clasping just one of those rough, familiar hands in both of his own.
"It's all right," Carlos insisted.
There wasn't a trace of fear in his eyes.
"All I need is for you to stay strong."
"I'll try."
Adam backed away into the darkness and landed on set. He'd thought it was a risky indulgence to put an amateur in even this tiny part, but Carlos had sworn that he wouldn't take offense if his one and only performance ended up on the cutting room floor. He just wanted a chance to know if it was possible, one way or the other. Detective number two said,
"You'll need to come with us, ma'am,"
then took Gemma Freeman's trembling arm in his hand as he led her away. In the editing suite, Adam addressed Cynthia bluntly.
"Tell me if I'm making a fool of myself."
"You're not," she said. "He's got a real presence. He's not going to do Lear, but if he can hit his marks and learn his lines."
Adam felt a twinge of disquiet, as if they were tempting fate by asking too much. But maybe it was apt. They'd propelled themselves into this orbit together. Neither could have gotten here alone. On the day they arrived, they'd talked a total stranger into breaking through a fence and hiking up Mount Lee with them so they could take each other's photographs beneath the Hollywood sign. Adam could smell the sap from broken foliage on his scratched forearms.
"Remember this guy," Carlos told their accomplice proudly. "He's going to be the next big thing. They already bought his script."
"For a pilot," Adam clarified. "Only for a pilot."
He rose up over the hills, watching day turn to night, waiting for an incriminating flicker of deja vu to prove that he'd been in this city before. But the memories that came to him were all from the movies. L.A. Confidential, Mulholland Drive. He flew east, soaring over city lights and blackened deserts, alighting back in their New York apartment, hunched over his computer, pungent with sweat, trying to block out the sound of Carlos haggling with the woman who'd come to buy their air conditioner. He stared at the screen unhappily and started removing dialogue, shifting as much as he could into stage directions instead.
"She takes his bloodied fist in both hands, shocked and sickened by what he's done, but she understands."
The screen went blank. The laptop should have kept working in the blackout, but the battery had been useless for months. Adam picked up a pen and started writing on a sheet of paper.
"She understands that she pushed him into it. Unwittingly, but she still shares the blame."
He stopped and crumpled the sheet into a ball. Flecks of red light streamed across his vision. He felt as if he'd caught himself trying to leap onto a moving train. But what choice did he have? There was no stopping it, No turning it back, no setting it right. He had to find a way to ride it, or it would destroy them. Carlos called out to Adam to come and help carry the air conditioner down the stairs. Every time they stopped to rest on a darkened landing, the three of them burst out laughing. When the woman drove away, they stood on the street, waiting for a breeze to shift the humid air. Carlos placed a hand on the back of Adam's neck.
Are you going to be all right?
We don't need that heap of junk,
Adam replied. Carlos was silent for a while. Then he said,
I just wanted to give you some peace.
When he'd taken out the memory stick and closed his wound, Adam went into the old man's room and lay on his bed in the dark. The mattress beneath him felt utterly familiar, and the gray outlines of the room seemed exactly as they ought to be, as if he'd lain here 1,000 times. This was the bed he'd been struggling to wake in from the start. What they'd done for each other. He didn't have to excuse it to acknowledge that. To turn Carlos in, to offer him up to death row, would have been unthinkable. And the fact that the law would have found the old man blameless if he'd done so only left Adam less willing to condemn him. At least he'd shown enough courage to put himself at risk if the truth ever came out. He gazed into the shadows of the room, unable to decide if he was merely an empathetic onlooker, judging the old man with compassion, or the old man himself, repeating his long-rehearsed defense. How close was he to crossing the line? Maybe he had enough now to write from the same dark place as the old man, and in time to outdo him, making all his fanciful ambitions come true. But only by becoming what the old man had never wanted him to be. Only by rolling the same boulder to the giddy peak of impunity, then watching it slide down into the depths of remorse, over and over again, with no hope of ever breaking free. 11. Adam waited for the crew from the thrift store to come and collect the boxes in which he'd packed the old man's belongings. When they'd gone, he locked up the house and left the key in the combination safe attached to the door. Gina had been livid when he'd talked to Ryan directly and shamed him into taking the deal. The family could have the house, but the bulk of the old man's money would go to a hospital in San Salvador. What remained would be just enough to keep Adam viable, paying his maintenance contract, renewing his license to walk in public, and stuffing unearned stipends into the pockets of the figureheads of the shell companies whose sole reason to exist was to own him. He strode toward the gate, wheeling a single suitcase. Away from the shelter of the old man's tomb, he'd have no identity of his own to protect him. But he'd hardly be the first undocumented person who'd try to make it in this country. When the old man's life had disintegrated, he'd found a way to turn the shards into stories that meant something to people like him. But Adam's life was broken in a different way, and the world would take time to catch up. Maybe in 20 years, maybe in 100, when enough of them had joined him in the valley, he'd have something to say that they'd be ready to hear.